When you speak about urban planning, it's not something that normally gets people going. Things like the war on the car will upset people when the population feels like they're being told you can't live the way you want to live. Seems to take hold. Well, that will get people worked up. Right now, the latest iteration of this idea of war on the car or urban planners deciding that they're going to socially engineer how we live is something called the 15-minute city. Mention these three words these days and you're sure to get an earful either about how this concept is the savior of our urban future or a global conspiracy to manipulate us. Like many things, the truth is likely somewhere in between. Hi, I'm Brian Lilly, your host for the Full Comment podcast. It's not often, as I said, that urban planning gets people worked up. It's something I say as a journalist who's covered politics across Canada for more than 20 years. I've covered City Hall for various stints in Montreal, Ottawa, and Toronto, three of our biggest cities in the country. I've covered provincial legislatures across the country to varying degrees and spent more than a decade on Parliament Hill. Yet this issue right now is getting people excited because of that idea that urban planners will tell us how to live. Well, what are the pros? What are the cons? Is this 15-minute city idea just an extension of the war on cars? Our next guest will be able to answer some of those questions. But before I bring him on, I want to remind you, please subscribe to the podcast. Whatever device you're listening on, whatever app, you can just hit subscribe. You can leave a review, hit the share button to let your friends know about all of this. Wendell Cox is an urban policy analyst, a visiting fellow at the Heritage Institute, among many designations that he holds. He's worked on both coasts of the United States on transit in Los Angeles. He replaced former New Jersey Governor Christine Todd Whitnum on the Amtrak Reform Council. He lives and breathes urban planning. He's advised around the world, and he joins us now from the St. Louis, Missouri area. Mr. Cox, thanks for the time.
Pleasure to be with you.
What is it about urban planning over the last several decades that seems to say, we know better than you, we're going to tell you how to live? Because as I said, the general public doesn't always get worked up on this, but when they do, they really do. And when I've been covering it as a journalist, it seems to be this, we know better than you what you need. And sure, you may want a house and a yard and a white picket fence, but we know better.
Well, you know, and the fact is, we do know better. People and their households do know better. We have seen urban planners going back to the mid-19th century conduct a war on the suburbs. And it, of course, later became a war on the automobile. And, you know, I'm no great lover of the automobile, but you know what the automobile does? It makes it possible for somebody in an area of about 2,800 square miles in the Toronto Population Center that goes, you know, all the way from, say, Oakville to Ajax to almost Barrie, to just about live wherever they want and work wherever they happen to be able to get a job that suits them and their employer. Works very well, and in fact, modern urban areas are far larger than they ever were before the coming of the automobile and could not be this large, that is, in terms of population, if it had not been about the automobile. And I would say that the point is to look at the revealed preferences of people and where they live. For example, in the Toronto area, you have seen over the years, the city of Toronto has done well in terms of population growth since the amalgamation, but the old city of Toronto actually had lost some population compared, I think, to the 71 census. And the point is that people have been moving to the suburbs. They have moved there to get more space. In the pandemic, they moved there not only to get more space in the yard, but also more space in the house because of all the remote working. And the public has stated its preference very well. You cannot find anywhere where suburban growth is lower than the core city growth. And by the way, it's gone even further because, as I indicated in a recent op-ed published out west, that is in Western Canada, the Toronto area lost 325,000, the Toronto metropolitan area lost 325,000 net domestic migrants, more people moving out of the metropolitan area than moving in. in the last 5 years. And where do they go? They went to places like Kitchener, Waterloo, Peterborough, London, etc., where they can get more space and a yard. And it's expensive, but it's a whole lot less expensive than it's become in the Toronto CMA.
As I said, we've had this repackaging of all these ideas around urban planning that no, you shouldn't live in Kitchener, Waterloo. You shouldn't live in the suburbs of Hamilton and then commute in. You shouldn't be living out in Langley and going into Vancouver. You should be living downtown. And if you're not living downtown, you should be living the same downtown lifestyle in a condo in the sky, in stacked housing of some sort. You should be using public transit. And the repackaging of it is this 15-minute city concept. Can you explain to us the good, the bad, the ugly about what that is?
Oh, sure. And let me suggest that this really helps me to make, I think, a really important point. This is not new. We have seen these people, the planning community, declare transit to be the superior mode and try to make everybody who drives a car feel guilty. Yet what have they done? Has transit share increased? No, of course it has not. You go back to 1950, a lot larger percentage of the people were taking transit. Why are they taking cars? Well, let me tell you why. Let me get off for a minute on the issue of access. There's research that basically suggests if you live anywhere, the average resident of the city of Toronto, now I'm not talking now about the metro area, the city of Toronto, the average resident of the city of Toronto can get to four times as many jobs by car as by transit. Now, that makes the choice real simple. Why do we use cars? Because our lives are far better as a result. And yes, the repackaging in the 15-minute city is interesting. Everybody, even people who basically say it's a bunch of baloney, as it were, are saying, wouldn't it be nice? And in fact, we have a city in the Western world that is sort of a 15-minute city, Paris. Elaine Berthaud, who is former principal planner in the World Bank, it took a look at the city of Paris, which has fewer people, by the way, than the city of Toronto, at 2.1 million people, and found, yeah, pretty much you can get to anything you need in the city of Paris, except that the 30% of the people who live in the city of Paris commute to places outside the city of Paris. And when it comes to commuting and jobs, I mean, why, the gas station may very well be within 15 minutes of you, but that isn't where you work if it's the only job available. And so the problem with the 15-minute city is, yes, it makes sense in our minds. It makes sense in what Alain Berthaud, who I mentioned before, called the ultimate utopia, in the minds of people who think they can figure out how things that can work, but they never deliver on the promise. I mean, you think of all the promises that have made by well-meaning, well-intentioned people in the Toronto area or the Vancouver area or the Calgary area about improving transit and getting people out of cars. Has it happened? Not anywhere.
Yeah, look, I grew up in the suburbs, and I raised my kids in the suburbs. So we lived in a rural setting for a while. Now I live in the middle of downtown Toronto, and most things that I want or need are within a 15-minute walk at most. I got a subway at steps outside my door, but I also have a car in the underground parking for when I need it, when I want to get out. To me, it shouldn't be either or, and yet I look at the new buildings going up around me, and I saw one the other day. I'm just trying to remember the exact numbers. It was going to be a 79-story building at Yonge and Bloor in Toronto, 1,118 residences, plus more than 1.1 million square feet of retail and office space. And for all those residences, more than 1,000 residents, million square feet of retail and office space, just 95 parking spaces for cars. But there would be more than 1,100 bike parking spots. That is urban planners trying to say, whether you work here or live here, you cannot have a car because we're going to make it expensive and impossible for that to happen. Even at Yonge and Bloor, people have cars.
Well, yes. And at Yonge and Bloor, I've talked to people at Toronto Metropolitan University who tell me about the long waits trying to transfer from one line to the other after work. The basic point is that, yes, indeed, you can build those kind of things. A lot of the same kind of development is happening in Los Angeles, which has, of course, a much a weaker core than Toronto. And as I look at the new buildings being built in Los Angeles, you're seeing at least one car parking space underground for every new condo. The point is, if that can succeed in the market, that's fine. But as long as you're not forced to do it, I applaud anybody that wants to live at Yonge and Bloor and not have a car. That's just fine. I don't think they're any more virtuous than you or I, but they are clearly appropriate in making their choices. But then look at how many people can even afford to live in that kind of a lifestyle. I mean, the point is to recognize that this 15-minute city can be theoretically achieved in some places without talking about commuting, by the way. That's a complete loser. Cannot happen. It can be achieved in the very dense core. So if you talk about the old Trinity Spadina electoral district there to the east of the core or to the west of the core, yeah, there where you get population densities of 10 or 15,000 people per square kilometer, absolutely, it works just fine, especially if you can walk to work. But the fact is the Toronto CMA is much larger than that, and you cannot make this kind of thing work in the modern urban area. You know, the core of Toronto is not an economic city. In fact, Ed Glaser at Harvard, one of the best urban economists around, basically has referred to the 15-minute city as an enclave or a ghetto, and basically said that what we need to do is basically show, and I'm paraphrasing him here, so I may be getting it wrong, we need to show what a dumb idea it is. Because our cities do not look like downtown Toronto. Our cities look like Newmarket, or they look like Halton, or they look like a lot of other people that maybe a lot of the people downtown have never been to. But that is where most people live, and that's not just Canada. That's Western Europe. That's Japan. That's all over the world.
You know an awful lot about Canada, and specifically Toronto, for a guy that lives in St. Louis.
Well, actually, I'm proud to say that as a kid, I lived in Canada for 3 years, and I've always had a great affection for the country, but I have done work there, and I'm very familiar.
And it shows both in your writing and the ease of conversation here. But you mentioned something that I think is key here. You said that people might want to live that lifestyle with no cars in the building and in biking and walking everywhere. And look, some weeks I don't take the car out. Sometimes I take it out a lot. It depends on what I'm doing, but that's my choice. And that's the choice of the person that decides they don't want a car. And it feels to me, seems to me, that modern urban planning wants to take away individual choice and say, well, we should all live in these cookie cutter apartments. I mean, 500 square foot, and we'll call it a 2-bedroom. And that's the extent of your choice. I don't think that's where the public is at.
Always. They're not even close to being there. I mean, I cannot believe the failure that must, if the planners really looked at how their theories have been implemented, they would have to recognize it's all been an abject failure. How can it be that 55% of the population of the CMA is outside the city of Toronto? And indeed, I saw a picture in one of the papers just a couple of days ago, a marvelous aerial view showing what the city looks like with all the single family dwellings in the city covering most of the area. And that's fine because Toronto's a wonderful place to live. But people have got to be allowed to make their choices. And you know what? They're going to make their choices. And we saw that happen in the pandemic around the world, from London to Toronto to San Francisco and Sydney and Tokyo. We basically saw people say, you know what, I can work from home. And you know what, I'm going to move. And so what we have is substantial exoduses from core cities, even more than has occurred in the last 70 years of suburbanization. As people have moved out to do hybrid work, people at Stanford are basically saying that, for a lot of people, like if you're working only 1 or 2 days a week, you can easily make a 2-hour commute for those few days. So the point is, the people are not in any position. The people are not going to have the urban planners dictating their ways of life, and life is going to become even more difficult for the planners in the years to come because of the fact that all of the advantages that everyone thought were necessary to, would force people to live in urban areas or when in metropolitan areas, you don't have to live there anymore. You can go to the rural areas. And it's happening all over Canada, all over the U.S., Australia, etc. So it's a new world.
I know several people who left the city, were living in the core, pandemic hit, they left the city, and they either left completely or they downsized what they had in the city, got something out in a rural area or a small town, and for the couple days a week that they come in, they've got a small either rental or purchased a small apartment with what they had left over from getting rid of their home. So it's not just anecdotal. Your statistics are showing it.
Oh, yeah. Well, for example, the whole 15-minute city idea, I mean, who's getting the credit for it, is a gentleman by the name of Carlos Moreno, who is a city of Paris. Actually, he's a professor at the Sorbonne. And what he's basically saying is that there are going to be great difficulties implementing this thing. You know, in Paris, for example, I'm trying to remember what it was here. You know, in Paris, for example, the city that he works for, which has 2.1 million people, so it's smaller than Toronto, the city that he works for and has a population density, mind you, about 15 times that of Toronto. Toronto, the core, the city of Toronto has about 4,000 people per square kilometer. Paris has 60,000. That makes it a whole lot easier to do the 15-minute city. But one has to step back and wait and ask, well, now what is Paris? Paris is an urban agglomeration of 11 million people. Only 2 million of those people live within the boulevard périphérique. And the rest of the place, there isn't any hope whatsoever of getting anything like the 15-minute city for anything. And that's how most of the world is. And, you know, most people, as we can see from their choices, would prefer to live in a place with some room, with yards and so on. And you know what? The transportation is such that, you can live an awful lot of these places with a 30-minute commute. And that's sort of the world standard, 30 minutes. And we do very well on that in the United States. Canada does comparatively well, but generally not as well because of your population densities being higher in the urban areas and generally the freeways being less numerous, especially, for example, in the Vancouver area.
Yeah, or issues like not having proper rain roads or different things that the American cities have embraced. Wendell, we've got to take a quick break, but when I come back, I want to ask you about two other things on the urban planning front. One that I know quite a bit about, green belts, and I think they're a failure.
Yeah.
The other one is congestion taxes, which is constantly raised, and I know you've studied that. So urban planners love these things. Are they the right answers? We'll talk to Wendell Cox about that when we come back. Greenbelts is a major political topic here in Ontario right now. I've lived for years in Ottawa, where we had one, and it is sacrosanct. You can't touch it. People truly believe that it saved the city, that it stopped suburban sprawl, and yet most people in the Ottawa area live outside the Greenbelt and drive into the Greenbelt when they're going to work. They drive across it to afford a home. They drive across it to go to work. It is the same thing in Toronto. It is the same thing everywhere that it's tried, but yet these ideas keep being proposed. So Wendell Cox, what's your view of Greenbelts? My personal experience is they lead to more suburban sprawl. They don't stop it. They just make you drive farther for it. But are there studies on it from people that haven't just drunk the Kool-Aid?
Well, I do a report every year now in the 18th annual version, the Demographia International Housing Affordability Survey. The biggest problem that I see with green belts is that the limitation on the amount of land that can be developed, and I'm not talking about you know, developing land like Atlanta, where the suburban lot sizes are way too large. I saw a recent picture, an aerial picture of Markham, where the house roofs almost touch one another. They're building them on such small lots in the suburbs there. But the point is, what we have seen happen in Toronto, and this is the Toronto CMA, since 2005, which was our first edition, was that the median house price, resale house price, and this includes apartments and everything, you know, any owned housing, went from 3.9 times the median incomes, median household incomes, to 9.5 times. Now, you want to know why we've got a cost of living crisis? You look at Vancouver, it's 12 times. You look at Dallas, Texas, it's 4 times. Now, the basic point is, it's sort of like what happens when the oil-producing nations of the world decide that they're going to cut supply. All of a sudden, our prices go up. Well, when urban planners and the people that follow them in the decision-making organizations, like in this case, the province of Ontario, when they decide to ration land for urban development that's well located for jobs in the Toronto area, it is going to force prices up. And by the way, no one should ever think that downtown Toronto has most of the employment. In the Toronto area, the Toronto CMA has got about 500,000 people working downtown, and you've got about 3.5 million people working in the rest in the CMA in total. The basic issue is it has destroyed housing affordability just about wherever it has been tried. Whether we talk about London, Sydney, Melbourne, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Denver, Portland, where it has been done, it has been associated with huge increases in house prices. And where it has not been done, we have never seen in a major metropolitan area in the 8 countries that we cover, we have never seen a major metropolitan area in which the multiple of the house of the income has exceeded 5. It should be 3 and used to be just about everywhere.
That's what I remember growing up being told. Well, you should look for an income that so 3 times your income, you can buy a home. And right now that makes whether it's Vancouver or Toronto, increasingly other centers are around the country, it is becoming increasingly difficult to do that. So we've got a provincial government here that says they're going to open up, I think it's about 7,500 acres of green, yep, protected green space. They're going to add in another 9,500 acres elsewhere and make it protected green space, part of the green belt. But this is not land that you would build a home on. The environmentalists say that's not good enough. You're just protecting land we wouldn't build on. We want you to protect land that you would build on. Well, one makes sense to build on because it's close to the urban or suburban areas, and one doesn't.
Well, you know, this is a real problem, a real contradiction in policy. You don't have to read the papers very often to find out that you have a problem of a very big affordable housing problem. There are, and I don't have the list, but there are cities in Ontario where the waiting list for subsidized housing is 10 years. Okay, now why is subsidized housing so oversubscribed, as it were? Well, part of it is because you qualify for subsidized housing by not being able to afford market rate housing. Now, if the median multiple, that's the multiple of the house price over the income, if it were still in the range of 3, you'd have a lot less call for affordable housing. And so when I hear all of the incredible opposition to the Ford government's proposal to loosen up the green belt a bit and try to improve affordability, it strikes me that the very same people who raised the loudest cries about the lack of affordable housing don't realize that it is the only way you're ever going to solve the problem. And everything leads me to believe that you can expect that house prices are going to continue to rise. I realize they're down now because of the pandemic demand shock.
But and the increasing interest rates.
Oh, yeah, of course, of course. So again, green belts, I mean, we have not, the the impact of green belts is to raise housing prices and reduce the standard of living, and it is going to make a much poorer standard of living in the long run for people in Toronto and Vancouver and San Francisco and Los Angeles, places that have these kinds of policies.
My understanding is that there's also been studies in places like Frankfurt, in London, England, in Seoul, that show that the rationale behind it, the reasons that these green belts were brought in, that the results didn't live up to the expectations.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, you go back to the literature at the start of these things, and one of the issues we were going to make these, it was going to improve housing affordability and all of that. It never happened. And this is a problem with utopian ideas. I mean, it's a problem with the 15-minute city. I mean, how in the world are you ever going to make this happen? There's no way you can afford to make it happen. So, these kinds of policies seem to routinely produce only success in the minds of the planners, but never on the ground.
Congestion taxes. London, England's had one for, I think, a couple of decades now. It doesn't appear that things have gotten better. They've been proposed here in Toronto, thankfully rejected by most of the people in charge, but still pushed by some. They are proposed to varying degrees in municipalities elsewhere. You've actually studied this and looked at their impact. Do they lessen congestion during the day? Is it just a revenue grab? Do they just divert traffic elsewhere?
Well, I'm not sure how much I've studied it. I certainly have views on it and can tell you. These kinds of proposals always get publicity that is far beyond what their results have been. The London congested taxing system, it begins in the west at Hyde Park. Now, you can just, on a good day, you can walk. It's about 3 miles from the core. The London, City of London covers about 700 square miles. I'm not sure how big the congestion pricing zone is, but it is very small. Similarly, in Stockholm, the congestion pricing is limited to the Stockholm Island, which is the core of the city. It may very well reduce traffic congestion, though, as I think, but there's a bigger issue here. You know, again, you hear, in addition to hearing about affordable housing in Toronto and Vancouver and everywhere else in the world, you're going to hear about inequality. And isn't it funny how no matter what happens, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, especially with respect to government policies. And all of a sudden now we're going to basically tell poor people that they're going to have to pay a congestion tax to drive on the freeways. Well, I'll tell you what I think will happen whenever you get an entire urban area that has decided, an entire metropolitan area, let's say, that's decided you're going to go with a congestion tax, then you wait to see the growth in Kitchener-Waterloo and Peterborough and Belleville.
Yeah, I would imagine, because people will say, I'm not doing it. The other day I had to drive out to Toronto suburbs to drop something off, and it was right on the northern border of Mississauga, where it meets Brampton. And this is kind of the logistics central for the greater Toronto area. This is where goods come in and goods go out. And in the way that many people who live this downtown urban lifestyle that I do, I'm now one of these downtown urban elitists, an awful lot of people have everything delivered. They order off Amazon. They order online. It goes through these suburban centers where people drive to work, where people drive for work. Bringing in congestion taxes, shutting down the roads with excessive bike lanes. How are your goods getting into the city at the end of the day? Whether it's to stock a store or resupply a restaurant, or the goods that you've ordered online, how are they getting in at the end of the day if you're just constantly shutting down traffic?
Well, yeah, I mean, the big problem here is a failure to understand how important mobility and access are in the economic life of the city. There's good research that basically suggests that the GDP or economic production of a city, and when I talk about a city here, I'm talking about the metropolitan area, increases to the extent that commute times are reduced. That you need these kinds of things, and unfortunately, the whole idea of thinking that everywhere can work like downtown is not going to work. And by the way, the Mississauga Brampton area is a good example also, because a few years ago, and they may have taken this down off the internet because of the publicity I made about it in a paper for the Frontier Policy Institute of Public Policy in Winnipeg. That area has more jobs, or at least 10 years ago, had more jobs than downtown Toronto. Now, granted, it's a whole lot more spread out, but that logistics area around the airport had more jobs than downtown Toronto, and was at that time claiming to be the largest commercial center in Canada, which it was and probably still is.
Well, it was vital during the pandemic. Those were the essential workers that kept going when other people were told to stay home.
Yep.
Where is the line on when investing in transit makes sense and when it doesn't? Because you said that, you know, the transit works sometimes, transit doesn't work in other situations. I've used transit my whole life, but had a car and a license since I was 16. I have a bike that I don't ride as much as I should. I walk. I use every mode of transportation that there is. But I've also lived in areas where they decide we're going to spend billions on transit. And you look around and you say, why do you need a light rail here? City of Hamilton put in a light rail system that will cost $5 billion. At least it's going to go over, I'm sure. And, that's my hometown. I know it well. I don't think that it needs that sort of transit. I think it could use a better bus system and improve roads, but I don't know that that's the right investment. Is there a population or density tipping point for transit? Because every single municipal council is on the bandwagon of we need an LRT.
Yeah, well, the thing about it is, no, there's not a population threshold, but there is a downtown threshold. Take a look at the route maps of transit systems around the world, essentially, and you're going to find they generally tend to focus on downtown. And the reason, for example, that they focus in downtown in Toronto or in Montreal or in Vancouver is that is the place where the employment density is the highest. I mean, downtown Toronto is like 500,000 employees, as I recall. Downtown Toronto is maybe 350, and downtown Vancouver maybe 200,000. That is where transit works. I can't remember what the exact figure is in Toronto, but as I recall, 60 or 70% of the people who work in downtown Toronto get there by transit. Yeah, that's pretty good. And we can argue about how much the subsidies would be, but that is the only place transit can serve effectively. Now, the other major point that you want, the other major use of transit is providing mobility to people that have low incomes, and this would be for other trips as well as commuting. But for example, in the United States, and I've never looked at the issue in Canada, but in the United States, people in poverty who are working tend to use their cars almost as much as the general public. Transit is not that big a deal. It's important, but it's not that big a deal. But the key is a strong downtown area. So if you go to places, you know, like Phoenix, for example, where they don't even have a downtown, with all due respect, and the money they've put into that, it's never going to make a difference in Phoenix. It's never going to make a difference in Seattle or Portland, even with their strong downtowns. The key, though, one must think about the fact that transit is about downtown, and that's the end of it.
You can, as you said, you know, look after low-income people, young people that can't drive, students, what have you. But to have a big investment, you're saying it's got to be a dense downtown core.
Yeah, and I forgot to say just one thing. You think about the Metrolink system. You realize that something, and this is old data, maybe 5 years old, so it may not be completely right, but the last time I looked, the number of trips that go through Union Station, that is either get on or get off at Union Station, which is, of course, downtown, 95% of the travel. And let's face it, I mean, Metrolink goes much further out than the TTC or the subway or anything like that. That really makes the case very well.
But that is effectively bringing people in. And at that point, when you're talking about so many people coming into a concentrated area for an employment core, then yeah, it makes sense to say, okay, how do we get people off the car? Because, I mean, imagine trying to, all those trips, trying to build highways to facilitate it without, expanding the highways to 24 lanes each way. That would be insufferable. Highway congestion and highway traffic at the same time. So at that point, it makes sense. But the war on the car does seem to go everywhere. It does seem to be something that, while maybe years ago it was something that downtown urban planners thought about, it seems that it is the predominant view. And so maybe 30 years ago, you might have a suburban town with an urban planner that thought differently. They thought, we're building a suburb. That's different than downtown. Has it changed within the urban planning set where most people are just in one mindset and trying to push this idea that keeps being repackaged 15 different ways? Is that the dominant view? Are you an odd one out?
Oh yeah, no question. But believe me, I'm by no means unique, and we're getting a lot more publicity, especially as a result of the pandemic and it having proven many of the things we've been saying for a long time. But the point is, the planners are, you know, they may be being a little more successful in getting their ideology out, but the people aren't listening. You can't, where, you know, I challenge anybody to show me anywhere where there has been any material change as a result of transit. And the reason for that is we're not building new downtown areas. I mean, you know, all of these downtowns we've got, which have huge transit market shares, you know, this is the six places in the United States, and certainly the four largest the six largest metropolitan areas, because Edmonton and Calgary do pretty well as well. With the exception of Edmonton and Calgary, all the downtown areas in Canada, the big ones, were built before World War II, as was also the case in the United States. Now, granted, these downtown areas have had some growth and all of that, but you can go to most of the metropolitan areas of the United States. We've got 56 with more than a million. So we've got 56 that are almost as large as Calgary and Edmonton. And they may have downtowns and they may very well have some impressive buildings, but in none of these urban areas or metropolitan areas do you find that more than about 5 to 7% of people that work in the metropolitan area use transit to get to work. And that's because they can get wherever they're going far faster by car.
Yeah, when I'm in Dallas-Fort Worth, it's easy to get around by car.
Well, that's right. In fact, I've often used DFW as an example to compare to Toronto, because the populations are very similar, the metropolitan areas in both places. And, you know, the planners always like to talk about how all these cars slow down traffic and everything like that. Well, you know what? The average journey to work time in Dallas-Fort Worth is 5 minutes shorter than in the Toronto CMA. And the fact is, the reason the car is dominant is because it meets the needs of the people in a way that transit can't. And by the way, I too was a transit rider for 15 years to downtown Los Angeles and enjoyed it a great deal. But at the same time, I was working downtown. I couldn't have gotten there anywhere else in the city on transit in a reasonable period of time.
And that is often a big part of the problem, is that, as you say, it serves downtowns because it makes sense. I remember in Ottawa trying to get my oldest son to Army Cadets, and it was a 5-minute drive, but it was an hour and a half bus route because of the circuitous route that you had to take in three transfers. It wasn't a system designed in a way that made sense for moving people around, except civil servants going down to the Parliament Hill area. That's all it was there for. So, when I was a kid, I took the bus to Army Cadets because it made sense. It doesn't always make sense. And I think that's something that the urban planners, I think, have to start understanding. And I think our politicians have to start understanding. Have politicians in much of North America been captured by these ideas, or they just glom on to the next one. And when 15-minute cities is done, it'll be called something else, and they'll still jump on it.
Well, you know what? I have a lot of sympathy for these elected officials who the problem is there's a very, very high price to pay on city councils. And I'm not speaking of any in particular here, because, quite frankly, the groupthink that takes over, the establishment oriented groupthink that takes over, especially in a lot of our larger city councils. And so that a councilor that sort of sees the problems is liable to be in real trouble with his or her colleagues. And you've hired these experts. They claim to be the best. They have the premature of the educational credentials on urban planning and so on. And so they're thought of as experts. Well, the fact is that there are a number of us out there, including me, who have been working for quite a long time to basically point out the contradictions here that show that what they are proposing is not feasible. It's utopian, and cannot occur.
So let me ask you, Wendell, as we wrap up here then, what is the future in terms of how people want to live? This is what you spend your day looking at. We've had this adjustment during the pandemic. Does that become a new normal? Are we going to go through another shift as people perhaps start going back into offices and downtown employment nodes, or is this shift permanent? Are we going to keep seeing a migration outward?
Well, my sense is it's at least partially permanent. I haven't looked at the Canada statistics from the 21 census on journey to work in the metro areas, but in the United States, we saw an increase of four times in remote work, working at home, between 2010 and 2020. This is happening around the world. The world has changed. Artificial intelligence.
And hold on. You said 2010 to 2020.
Right.
That's well before the pandemic. I guess it would take up.
We actually have 2021 data. We have an annual survey that's okay. Run by the federal government. Sorry about that. This is a permanent change. It doesn't mean downtowns are finished or anything, but it's really interesting. I mean, I'm always seeing articles in various publications about how all of a sudden, well, we're going to bring the people back downtown. And then when you read the fine print, you hear that the employers are being asked to come in 3 days. Well, listen, downtown Toronto that operates essentially Tuesday through Thursday does not need the same level of transit 5 days a week that it did before. And so the world has changed. I think the move to sort of the more electronic office was way overdue. The technology has been there for a long time. And, I really don't think building office buildings is a real good investment. And that's not investment advice at this point.
All right. Wendell Cox, thanks so much for your time. It's been a fun and an enlightening conversation.
Thank you.
Full Comment is a Post Media podcast. My name's Brian Lilly, your host. This episode was produced by Andre Pru with theme music by Bryce Hall. Kevin Lebon is the executive producer. Remember, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, Amazon Music, listen through your app, Alexa-enabled devices, and you can help us out by giving us a rating or leaving a review. And make sure you tell your friends about us. Until next time, thanks for listening.